is Austin, welcoming you to the LL Research Radio program In the Now, Q&A with Carla and crew. Today is Tuesday, September 9th, 2014. Carla L. Ruckert is an author, mystic, seeker, and primary channel for LL Research. The crew in the title refers to those of us at the LL Center, beginning with Jim McCarty, Carla's husband, scribe for the Raw Contact, and president of LL Research. Gary and I, devoted seekers of the Law of One, manage LL from the home office. LL Research is a nonprofit organization dedicated to freely sharing spiritually oriented information and fostering community, and towards this end has two websites. The archive website, llresearch.org, and the community website, bringforth.org. Together they offer over 1,300 channeling transcripts, 11 publications, the Law of One material, interviews, speeches, forums, blogs, chat rooms, and more. We will be discussing questions that come from you. If you would like to ask us a question live on the air, please call 646-595-2294 and press the 1 key when prompted. Again, that number is 646-595-2294. If interested in submitting a question when we're not on air, please visit our show's webpage at blogtalkradio.com/LLResearch. When submitting questions, please remember that this is a Law of One Q&A. Try to keep your questions as spiritually oriented as possible. Again, I'm Austin, and we're talking with Carla L. Ruckert and the home crew of LL Research. Is everybody with us and ready to go?
You betcha.
Ready to roll.
Indeed.
All right. We can go to our opening riff before we get to our questions. This one comes from Kuo from a session on December 26th, 2009. Kuo says, "The nature of all that is not the one original thought is to be distorted. Distortion is not a bad word. Distortion is not an insulting word. There is distortion in all manifestation, even the highest and best you can imagine. If there were no distortion, there would be no creation, for the creation itself and its manifested aspect is a series of nested distortions. Thusly, one is not attempting to remove distortion completely, but rather to allow it to become more coherent, to change stuttering and muddy colors to laser lights and jewels."
Thank you, Austin. What in heaven's name is not distorted? What does that mean? How could distortion not be some kind of insult? Well, when you come right down to it and you look at the way the Ra group talked about the beginning of the universe, first there was the one original thought of love, but it did not know itself as that. So the first distortion was free will. And using this free will, it decided to know itself better. To do that, it had to make something to objectify itself so it could watch itself. How many times have you wanted to do that? Have you wanted to be able to see yourself as others see you? Get some dirt that isn't so expensive, doesn't take so much of your time. I certainly have. You know what that beep is, Gary? We have an unknown beeper. Okay, I'm going to ignore it.
I don't hear anything on this end.
Oh, okay, it must be me. My phone is beeping at me. All right. It's distorting. It's laughing at me. Oh, the Creator has such a sense of humor. It's distorting. Okay, distorting. I'd like to say that it's a greatly mysterious word, but it isn't. It's logical. It's practical. We want to see ourselves as others see us, if we want to objectify ourselves. somehow we have to make ourselves out there so that we could see a self that is in here. That's what the Creator did. He took all his little bits and pieces and flung them out into the universe. They call it the Big Bang. I call it the third distortion? I don't know. Anyway, he wanted to see himself, so he made a manifested universe, which was an expression of itself. And that included all the planets and their courses, and all of us in the constant bewilderment and order and logic and mystery of our lives. All the little bits and pieces that are us. If we move that distortion upwards, we come to the infinite Creator very quickly. We are love. We are the Creator's expression of itself. But just to make things more interesting for itself, the Creator cast us within a veil of forgetting so that our free will would be entirely manifest. And if we didn't want to believe that we were the Creator, we didn't have to. There was no proof. Now, if we really focus, we might eventually come to the conclusion that we were expressions of the Creator, but that's a stretch. Once the Ra group explained the logic of its cosmology to us, however, for the Ra is talking to us about a philosophy, not a religion, we were able to see what they meant, that everything we look at is a distortion, part of a group of nested distortions, just as our liver and our bloodstream and our heart and our lungs are all part of our body, part of the nested distortions that, taken all together, working all together, held together by the distortion of the skin, within that skin lies a group of nested energy fields which create a vibration. And we have a great deal to do with that vibration. We can choose precisely how we want to vibrate. We can vibrate love. We can vibrate fear. We can vibrate all kinds of aspects in between those two. Can be eternal light and day within our personal experience, or we can choose to have nothing but night, to dwell in darkness, gloom, doom, and fear. What have you chosen today? What have I chosen today? The Creator is now in the process of gathering information. We are not the top of the food chain. Our experiences are the Creator's food, and it eats them with great interest and joy. Well, if everything is a distortion, where is our bottom line? Where can we stand and know that what we are standing on is, quote, real, close quote? It turns out within this logic that the only source of reality for us is within ourselves, what we choose to believe. I do think that the Ra group makes it easier for us to choose the light, the joy, the truth, ideals that we instinctively turn to when we think of what force density might be like. But it did not make, the philosophy does not make it proof-worthy. It isn't anything you can prove. It makes logical sense, but that logic is entirely internal. So it's one of those things where you do well to do the math once. Really seriously sit down and focus on that first statement of the rock group. We are thoughts. Not bodies. Most distortions are not nearly as high in the truth chain, not nearly as full of truthiness as what we think, what we create to think, what we intend to do. We are dancing a dance with each other within that rhythmic dance of the universe. And our dance is somewhat eccentric because we have not yet decided to live life without distortion. That is, to live life within the distortions that are true. Don't you love philosophy? And then once you've done the math one time, really sat down and realized that we are not bodies experiencing ourselves as spiritual. We are spiritual beings experiencing ourselves as bodies. This body thing is interesting, and we did it for reasons that are very good, that last, that stick. We can work with this body. We can cooperate with how we feel, how we think, how the body feels, what the body wants. We can focus on all of those things. We can try to give the body what it wants, the mind what it wants, the spirit what it seeks. Try to be ourselves. That's the thing. Once you realize that you are thoughts, you need to move into that mode of thinking where all of this other stuff about bodies is accepted as fake stuff. It's a mask over our essence, which does not have a manifestation. It is consciousness. And what is consciousness? It is as close as the space between my words. It is the space on the page between. Truth is as close to us as our breathing. Closer. We simply need to stop talking and pay attention to ourselves. It's a strongly recommended exercise. Where is the love this moment within your? That is what Ra asks us to determine. There is love within this moment. Can you find it? It's good to seek that love. When you have found it, to share it, to laugh, to hug, to embrace. To love each other as the Creator loves us. I wish you the joy of this moment. the joy of your essence, of your beauty, of your being part of the one infinite creator. So reach out and touch. You are the creator, and what you do makes a difference. I love you all.
Thank you so much, Carla. We actually have a couple of callers on hold. The caller from area code 337 has been holding longer. So, caller from 337, you are
Hi. Now
on the air. With whom are we speaking?
How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm good. I wanted to call next about my love life. If you maybe see like a long-term relationship, like a spiritual connection or something that may be coming my way pretty soon.
Are you, you're calling looking for a sort of psychic reading? Let me just tell you a little bit about our show. We don't do any kind of readings or anything. We kind of discuss spiritual philosophy and spiritual topics from a human level. We wish we could help you, but we don't have any sort of psychic perception or metaphysical perception like that.
Oh, I'm so sorry about that.
Oh, that's okay.
No, yeah, don't apologize. It's okay.
I just am sorry you got the wrong number. This has happened quite a bit lately, and we don't know what to do about it. We've told Blog Talk Radio that it's not our number, and we've, you know, shaking a leg, but they haven't heard us so far. So it's us that we should be apologizing to you.
Yeah.
I hope you find an answer to your question, sweetheart.
Sorry that we can't be more help for you.
So we love you. That's all we can do. I'm sorry.
All righty. And our next caller is from area code 951. Area code 951, you are now on the air. With whom are we speaking?
It's Nathaniel.
Hello, Nathaniel. What can we do for you?
Can you send healing from a distance?
Unfortunately, we don't have... this is more of a human-centric. We don't address things from a metaphysical level on this show, but we can certainly offer a prayer.
And we're sorry. You've been given bad information. This is not the right telephone number for that. See what you can do to find the right one, and we hope you find an answer.
Nathaniel has left us. Okay. Well, it's a good thing we have some questions sent in.
Yes, it is, because we don't have an audience as we thought we did.
No.
I'm sure there are others, though.
Unfortunately, the issue is Blog Talk Radio, our show is listed as a spiritual show, and almost all the other shows on Blog Talk Radio listed under that setting are psychic shows. And so people see our show under that heading and assume that we are also psychics. So there's
so
not a whole lot
it.
We can do about it. Did you say something, Gary?
I was going to say we should change it to sports in that case. It would definitely cut off the psychic questions, but then we might get some other kind of questions. It would be difficult to...
Them could really shine.
Yeah, yeah. We might be able to talk about those a little better than the psychic questions. Okay. Our first sent-in question comes from our friend JP via email. And JP asks, Carla's enlightened definitions of such things as the Christian communion are way ahead of its time. In that light, what is her definition of the apple in the Garden of Eden?
Well, JP, you've got to realize that I think for myself, and nobody else might agree with me. So this is not, I have not learned this from somebody else. This is a homemade, sewn together with me only opinion. I think that the apple represents the tree of life, the tree of knowledge, of good and evil. And when you know good and evil, all of a sudden things that before you were totally innocent of all of a sudden become morally questionable, like, for instance, being naked. That's what it says in the Bible. They became aware that they were naked after they ate the apple, and they sewed fig leaves together, which seems to me a very, very wrong way to go. Fig leaves aren't big enough, but maybe they had fig trees bigger in the Garden of Eden. I don't know. Anyway, I think that when you're really totally innocent, you don't have a thought about this is good or this is bad. It's simply what is. You accept it at that level. And we babes in the woods have a tendency, even now, to accept things as they seem. But if you've eaten of the tree of life, of the tree of knowledge of good and evil, you become responsible for your knowledge of good and evil. It becomes a totally different world to you. You are enlightened as nobody but the gods have heretofore been enlightened. And so you can't dwell in innocence anymore. You have to be out there where you can express your knowledge of good and evil. The Creator can't protect you from knowledge that you're naked. It feels perfectly okay to be naked. If you've ever done it for any length of time, you forget that you don't have any clothes on, and life becomes normal, being unclothed. And that's, I'm sure, exactly the way Adam and Eve felt. They were children, basically. And I see the apple as representing our adulthood, our maturity, or our possibility of maturity.
I think something's wrong with your phone, Carla, because I think I hear you talking, but I don't hear it through the phone.
Yeah, same here.
We have some technical difficulties.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, your phone's messing up. Bear with us just one moment, folks. It looks like this is out of battery somehow.
So I'll need to hold the phone. We got another.
You could call in on her cell phone, worst comes to worst.
I think we have another handset, don't we?
Our telephone just decided that it wanted to be in the Garden of Eden, and it didn't want to know good and evil, so it left us. Can you hear us now?
I can hear you.
Yeah, we can hear you, Carlo. We're trying to get Jim worked out because he sacrificed his headset for you.
Okay.
So you can keep on talking. We'll figure things out.
All right. I just wanted to make sure that people could hear me talk. I was just about finished anyway. This kind of thing distracts your train of thought. But, I see the apple as representing knowledge of good and evil, enlightenment. And interestingly enough, one of the words for Satan involves the word for light. So there is that aspect to Satan that it's not evil as much as it is knowledge of good and evil, not evil as much as the knowledge of what is evil. Okay, does anybody else have anything to say on that point?
Yeah, I've got some words to add. Sorry about the difficulties to our listeners, but I have a really similar interpretation, sort of in a more macrocosmic view, I think. And I can't take complete credit for this interpretation because it is inspired by a book called Ishmael by Daniel Quinn, which is a really good sort of philosophical book that helped me start to think alternatively about our society. But it also talked a little bit about mythology, and especially biblical mythology, in terms of humans' separation from nature. And so my interpretation, really, you have to take away the component of sin, the idea that man was cast out from the garden as punishment for eating the fruit. And if we remove that component, then we just have man originating in God's garden, living in harmony with the nature that surrounds them, not worrying about what might be good or what might be evil in their environment. And since humans have not eaten from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, everything just is. There's no judgment of good, no judgment of evil, like
mm-hmm.
you were saying, Carla.
It seems like it's second density.
Yeah, that's what I was about to say. It's as if that is second density perspective. There's just existing within nature without realizing the self as being separate from nature. Everything that happens within nature is just part of what happens, and there's no sort of value judgment placed by a second density being.
And if you've ever seen a cat or a dog that's your beloved pet, or even a horse, I've had a horse that get in this situation, undergo severe pain. You can see the animal, you know, reacting to the pain. Ow, ow, ow. But it doesn't have any component of, why me, why me? It just is.
Yeah, it's reacting instinctually to that pain,
mm-hmm.
and it doesn't sort of go off later and say, oh, I can't believe I suffered that.
It doesn't suffer. Therefore, in the way that we suffer, because we're aware that this pain exists, and we want to know why.
Right, and then that's sort of the eating of that fruit. I would sort of consider that the transition to third density, where we don't necessarily live in God's garden anymore, in the sense that we don't just allow things. Things don't just happen naturally. We sort of view them as abstract things that can be good or can be evil. And, you know, things that are evil that happen to us, we think about that and we dwell on it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically the catalyst that third density allows us to experience. And so we can assign judgments of things that happen in nature and things that we do as good or evil.
Exactly. And you can see people doing that, making religions out of what animals would never think of doing that. You know, ascribing mythical power
mm-hmm.
to various animals.
Right, and even like worshiping the sun as a god.
Uh-huh, or the mountain, Fuji.
Yeah, for an animal, the sun just is. It doesn't even enter the mind of an animal to consider this thing as being the source of all life.
No, it just turns to it because it feels good.
Right, yeah, and that's the instinctual turning to the sun, and then we as humans, as third-density humans, we can sort of assign a term, a judgment that says the sun is good, it gives us energy, and we think about it abstractly. So the terms good and evil, they carry sort of a charge of value judgment in a really simple sense. But figuring out what is good and what is evil is sort of what we do as third-density beings. Not necessarily in the sense that good and evil are universal judgments, but we have to figure out what is good for us and what is not good for us. And we have to choose how we act, decide the morality of our actions, and decide whether we want to be good or evil in our own terms. And that's sort of what I think the eating of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil represents. We're still trying to get our technical difficulties sorted out, so bear with us for just another moment.
Yeah, I was just suggesting to Jim that he come in and put the little receiver back on the power stand where it might be receiving power, and then maybe he could talk there. I think he's taking it apart at this point. Okay. No, he's putting it back together. He corrected me on that. Okay. He's stalking out of my reality system.
I think that we almost have it figured out. We could try using the battery from this one and that one, because we weren't able to use this one.
Somehow the thing that's supposed to charge it for battery didn't. So that's an underlying difficulty, literally.
And it's possible we have a replacement battery. We'll get everybody back.
Oh, that's good. God bless replacements.
Weird that both of the headsets went wonky on the same day, because the one that Austin was going to use to host the show didn't work, so he grabbed
the
handset
goodness.
That I would have grabbed, and I'm calling in on my cell phone
uh-huh.
for that reason. And
well,
now your headset is going wonky.
Mickey, maybe you could call in on your own phone, on your cell phone. I don't know if he could hear me say that.
I don't think so.
I see.
Yeah. I'll give him the guest line.
Maybe you could.
You can come in and take a seat.
Well, we've got about half an hour left.
I'm running out.
Okay.
I'm going to get actually.
Well, whatever you'd like to do.
I'm
I wanted to ask you about getting the rings off.
Okay.
If you could give them maybe a try, and then we're going to have to go to a jeweler and have a cut off.
Okay. Yeah.
We heard.
And we are now back. Really sorry about that, folks. We just had a very strange culmination of events that put us offline for just a few minutes. So Carla and I were discussing JP's question about the apple from the Garden of Eden, from the Tree of the Knowledge of Good and Evil. Gary or Jim, did you have anything to add to any of that you might have heard?
Yeah, I've got a couple thoughts. One is that I wanted to read from Eckhart Tolle, because he invokes this event or metaphor in biblical history and, of course, interprets it metaphorically, not literally. That is, he invokes it. I've seen him on multiple occasions speak to it. And here's one example. He says, first, this is in an interview that I got this from. He says, first, we need to see clearly what the ego is. It's not just being selfish or arrogant or thinking yourself superior. Ego is identification with the stream of thinking. The beginning of ego is described in the Old Testament with the famous story of the apple. Adam and Eve ate the fruit of the tree of the knowledge, and they lost that state that is externalized in the Bible and called paradise. They lost a deeper state of connectedness. I don't think it was as immediate as it's described in the Bible. To me, that story is about the rise of the ability to think, like Austin was saying, to think abstractly. Eckhart Tolle continues, to make judgments. This is good, that is bad. And I believe it took a long, long time of increased thinking until people reached a point where they derived their entire sense of who they are from the stream of thinking, the mind-made entity composed of memories, past conditioning, and mental concepts. This is the ego that people identify with. Like Carla was describing the horse who feels pain, the horse basically doesn't create a story about itself out of that pain. It just experiences that pain in the moment and moves on. And higher density entities like horses, I'm sure, have some memory that they keep with them. But for the most part, they haven't created an individualized identity, unless, I guess, they're third density harvestable. But my own thoughts largely are exactly congruent with what Austin and Carla said. And I was going to say exactly the transition into third density, like Austin said. So I'll skip that part of my response and just move on to my final thought, that the apple is, to my mind, that seed concept or idea that the self is separate. The self isn't one with all things. And And thus begins the many, many judgments that arise from eating the apple. It's an act that casts those beginning third density entities out of their true consciousness, their natural and actual estate, as symbolized by their sudden ashamed awareness of their nakedness. But I see the eating of the apple as a necessary step in this octave of existence. The apple initiates the long journey of the individual that seems to leave the Creator only to eventually return. So when the individual returns, it comes back into its natural state, he or she will do so in a post-egoic rather than a pre-egoic state. That is, they will have transcended the ego or the separate self and have gained all the fruits of experience from that long journey of separation. And finally, those that undertake this journey in the positive polarity will return sooner than those of the negative polarity who have an even longer road before re-entering the garden out of which they cast themselves. That's
okay.
It for me.
Well, thanks, Gary. Did you have anything you wanted to add, Jim?
Maybe just a little short thing. Back in the 50s, an author by the name of George Hunt Williamson wrote a book called Road in the Sky. And it was concerned, he was one of the first contactees of extraterrestrials of, we believe, a positive nature. One of the phrases he got in a contact was, "To apples we salt, we return." And sometimes in other writings, wanderers have been termed apples. And I'm thinking that the apple of the tree of life in the Garden of Eden may also be symbolic of the greater reality that there are those who partake in and wish to be of service to us by sharing it with us. These apples are fruit of the true nature of things. And these beings that have salted the apples or the truth, or maybe even wanderers from their density, come back to help with the harvest. They return. And I think that what we're about to see here, hopefully on planet Earth, is a harvest, so that there are many apples around that will be helping with the illumination of the population. That's it.
Thank you.
Austin, I wanted to note real quick that this question caused me to read that story in Genesis for the first time, and I found a part that I thought was particularly funny. And the Lord God has learned that Adam and Eve have eaten this fruit, and so he finds Adam, like, hiding because he's naked, and approaches Adam and says, "Hast thou eaten of the tree whereof I commanded thee that thou shouldest not eat?" And the man said, "The woman who thou gavest to be with me, she gave me of the tree, and I did eat." So
she made
the Lord God.
Classic.
Yeah. So the Lord God said unto the woman, "What is this thou hast done?" And the woman said, "The serpent beguiled me, and I did eat." It's like the man throws the woman under the bus, the woman throws the serpent under the bus, and nobody's taking responsibility for this initial act. I thought, I guess that's a trait
so
you can see today. What's that?
The serpent is so busy wiggling along the ground and trying to find his voice that he has nothing to say.
Yeah, he takes the final line. So I just thought it's a trait you can see today, and it goes back to very early beginnings. Not taking responsibility.
We should really thank that serpent, because it's part of becoming mature spiritually to take stock of one's reality and to become a responsible part of creation. So we would not have been able to do that if we had remained a second density.
Yeah, I think that idea of original sin just has to be, if this can be interpreted positively, just kind of has to be left behind. Because then if you do that, then you feel like the natural progression from second density to third density is wrong, and there's something inherently bad about it.
And there's something inherently wrong with women. I mean, don't forget that part.
Right, yeah.
Or inherently wrong.
Women,
with
most
truth.
Those women, they're just wicked. I mean, they're just, you know. And, hey, wait a minute. We're part of you.
Yeah.
Well, suggesting that something's wrong with truth, too, that we shouldn't be knowing it. Lucifer, literally translated, means light bringer.
Yeah, that's what I was referring to when I said one of the names for the devil actually refers to the bringing of light.
So that suggests that either this, we shouldn't be looking at the devil quite so much askance, or we should be looking at truth a little more askance. I'm not sure.
Yeah, so if we just sort of get rid of the whole where we get cast out as punishment from the Garden of Eden, it's sort of just the natural progression of we live in the Garden of Eden, we stumble upon this tree and we eat its fruit, and then we are no longer in the Garden of Eden because our consciousness is raised above a certain level, and we are entered into a new level of reality where we don't really have our groundings and we're able to see things differently.
And as Gary said, we become to take stock and feel that we, you know, that we are experiencing ourselves living life, not just living life. So there's a witness in there. And you know, who is the witness? It's certainly not the serpent. It's not the knowledge of the tree of good and evil. It's just part of our reality.
Anybody else have anything to add to JP's question? All right,
Jim.
Question, JP. Our next question comes from user Mark Day via Bringforth, who asks, who are the four archangels that I have seen mentioned, and what are their areas of focus / support, if their aid is more specific than general?
Jim, in terms of the Kabbalah, you're the expert among us. Why don't you take that one?
Well, the Archangel Gabriel is the one that is supposedly in charge of the eastern direction, far as north and south and east and west goes, and of the quality of air. It has a yellow quality associated with it.
Lots of different undertones, but
right.
Yellow is the
primary. Right. And then to the west is Raphael. And this is the archangel in charge of the general elements of water. And it has a blue tint that goes with it. And then in the south is Michael. And it is in charge of the energies of fire and has a red tint that goes with it. And oftentimes you see it with a sword in its hand raised.
That's the sword of truth,
right?
According to the Kabbalah.
And then on the north, or the left side of the magician performing the ritual, is the angel Uriel. And this is the one in charge of the elements of earth. And it's often seen sowing seeds from a bag that's slung around its neck and has a deep red and green tint.
Like the colors in the fall, you know, all the earth tones. Brown.
Yeah, so that's basically it on the archangels. I don't know what else, what are their areas of focus and support?
Well, you know, there are other metaphysical things that if you think about it, you can create for all of that. You can create a whole symptomology or mythology that goes with that, of which they have. And you can look at them on the Tree of Life, of which they are a part, the main glyph of a Kabbalah. And think more deeply and more lucidly. But that has to do with learning about the archetypal mind rather than the essence itself. It has to do with the roots of the tree of mind rather than who we are altogether.
When I was looking up some information for this question, I discovered something interesting in that the arc and archangel is the same prefix as the arc and the archetypal mind. You could, I guess, kind of say that the archangels are like archetypal angels, archetypal
mm-hmm.
energies.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that their energies might be even more primal than our specific archetypal mind. They seem to have, like, the most primal energies in the universe. And all of those types of energies and concepts can, I think, can be seen as reflected in the tarot that Ra talks about, and just the archetypes in general. So it seems to me like in that sense they're sort of just a sort of part of the structure of the universe at a very primal level.
Mm.
Gary, did you have anything to add to that?
No, nothing at all.
Okay. Mark Day goes on to ask, in the same vein, what would be the best way to ask for help from the array of helpers of light? From what I've read, there are many helpers waiting to be asked to help, from personal angels to the archangels to the higher self, and I'm looking for some guidance on how to ask for help, whether it be speaking words or thinking them or being silent after setting an intention. I'd like to know more about the different methods and their effectiveness.
Well, in the morning when Jim does the banishing ritual as part of our ending of the morning offering, when Jim invokes each of the archangels, I make a prayer. My prayer for the archangel Raphael is to give me light, you know, give me enlightenment. My prayer for the archangel, what's the healer?
Gabriel.
Gabriel is, please give me an awareness of my wrongdoing that I may correct it. My prayer for Michael is, please help me to use the sword of truth, to see and know the sword of truth, and to use it with care. And my prayer for Auriel is, please help me to work in this density, because it really sort of represents Malkuth. It represents, you know, the kingdom of everything, the 10,000 things, I think the Buddhists call it. And it's sort of where you start. So I think that you can look at the aspects, the various aspects of the various archangels, and figure what energies that you want to invoke. Now, as far as I know, there are different angels that have been known to help with different aspects of life. And there are books that you can get that will cue you into what some of the people before you have used these archangels, or not archangels, but angels in general, to help pray for. Myself, I just prayed to St. Patrick one day when I was looking for a parking place, and I got one. So St. Patrick became my go-to angel for all questions of where the heck am I, and helped me get a parking place, everything to do with driving in a car. So I think you can make some of this stuff up, and it still works. Because angels just like to help.
Gary, did you have any additional words?
I don't know or have any thoughts to offer regarding angels specifically. It's not familiar territory to me. But nor do I really know how and in what way prayer or invoking light or asking for assistance really works, but I have some thoughts regarding just some of the basic principles, and I think that some factors that go into the efficacy of prayer or invoking help, you might say, include sincerity of intention, purity of intention, strength of desire, and intensity of desire. And within intensity, I don't know what part frequency or constancy play, whether a prayer expressed intensely once is just as effective as a prayer expressed frequently or multiple times over a period of time. But I think all those things factor in. And then while thinking about this question, a quote from Ra came up that also speaks to this to some extent. Don is asking about the mechanism of inspiration in 38.4, and Ra says, the mechanism of inspiration involves an extraordinary faculty of desire, or will to know or to receive in a certain area, accompanied by the ability to open to and trust in what you may call intuition. So Ra's statement kind of divides that up into two parts. There's the will or desire, which they qualify as extraordinary, so I presume it is of some strength. That's the first half. And then the second half is being sensitive to or open to the promptings and the information that comes through the intuition. And it's interesting, Ra says intuition rather than like specifically comes from the external environment. So while the external environment may provide some kind of medium or vehicle, it's really your intuition that you're listening to, and it's really that seems to be the portal or interface between your decision-making faculties, your perception, and whatever help you may request or call for. That's my thoughts.
I've certainly experienced that firsthand in asking for help and then trusting intuition as far as just following impulses, especially if they're impulses that seem like they come out of nowhere. I've definitely followed impulses and met people that I know that I was supposed to meet or been put into situations that have been crucial to my personal journey. So that makes a lot of sense.
Well said. I agree with both of you. And think that that's quite crucial. The use of the will is quite crucial. And your faith, of course, the steadiness of your faith, those two things. So that you form an intention and then hold it in your mind as a picture you could hold. You see what I mean?
Indeed, absolutely. There's another... go ahead, Gary.
I was going to bounce off what you said, Austin, and that's that, like, likewise, I seldom have seen a blazing answer to a question in the sky or been, like, hit over the head with something that's just as clear as day and says, do this or go that way. Rather, I think, especially as I look back on my life, I can see one step flowing to the next in rather, you know, amazing, remarkable, sometimes synchronistic ways. And presume that, like you were saying, Austin, my intuition has received guidance, though it has not been always recognized as such by me. But I have been guided to choose one thing or another to lead me where I am today. That's all.
I'll say this for sure, because I remember the first day that Gary came to L&L Research, and it had been a real journey for him, literally, to get from Ohio and a job and you know, things that he was entangled in there to here. And he finally made it after several months of work. It was really hard work on his part to get here. So he finally gets here. He's pretty exhausted by this whole thing. And he looks at me and he gives me a great big hug, which is not normally something he does every day. And he says, I'm here, and as long as I can work to change the course of to lighten the consciousness of planet Earth, I am thrilled to be here. Thank you so much. I'm going to hug you like this every day of my life. And although I haven't had physical hugs, I have definitely, Gary, had the metaphysical hugs of your incredible usefulness and beauty in your job as you have taken it, thank God, out of my inept hands and shaped it into something entirely new. It's wonderful to watch, and it's still L&L Research, up, down, and sideways. There's no question about it. It's exactly what I would do if I had the knowledge you do. I don't know anything about technology. And I'm going, yeah, Gary, that sounds like a good idea. Well, he does all the bits and pieces of making L&L up-to-date technologically, which is still something we're working at.
Well, we all make a great team, and thank you for giving me something beautiful to hug every day, even if it doesn't happen on a physical level always.
It would be an effort, wouldn't it? Let's see. Set the time aside, 5 minutes for hugging Carla.
I do try
that part.
I do try to get physical hugs where I can, and we give half hugs, sort of, as you're on your hospital bed.
Yeah.
Okay. So we're almost out of time. Any last words to Mark Day's question?
I think I've expended myself.
None for me.
Covered it pretty well. How about you, Jim? Carla, do you have any last words for our listeners?
Listeners, thank you so much for being here. We love you. We love you all. And if we can do anything to make our service to you better, please let us know. If you have questions for us, please ask them. We have no idea if we can help you with them, but we'll sure give it a shot. And one thing's for sure, once we get finished with a question, you've got several ways to go, several arrows in the air that you can follow to their destination to see if that's useful for you.
Yeah, I like to say that we discuss questions. We don't answer them. We just talk about them.
Yeah, we give people tools, if we possibly, you know, that are of various ways and means of valuing them.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're valuable to some, to others perhaps not.
All right. Well, we are very sorry for the technical difficulties that happened halfway through the show.
It was synchronistic, all of it, I'm convinced. It doesn't play.
Yeah, there's a lot that went wrong.
Yeah, too much for it to be anything but synchronicity.
Yeah, something was going on today.
We got to maybe look to improve our system.
We will work on it. And you have been listening to LL Research's In the Now, Q&A with Carla and crew. If you've enjoyed the show, please visit our websites, llresearch.org and bringforth.org. Thanks so much for listening, and a special thank you to those of you who submitted questions. If you'd like to submit a question for us before the next show, please read our instructions on our page at blogtalkradio.com/LLResearch. Have a wonderful week, and we'll be here next Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern. Talk with you then.
I land on an island coasted, only so that I see a ghost. I run through a wooded island, chase the sunlight mile after mile. It feels like I know this place, and a tree line breaks in the wide open space. I stare at a bright red sun, search all day and never find anyone. Walk on a winding road, deep in the night, near the edge of the known. I pass by a moonlit lake, and the cold wind blows, and my bones start to shake. And I feel I should know this place, as the road winds on in the wide open space. The wind plays a haunting tune.